This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the land on which we're lucky enough to raise our sons and daughters. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land. This episode of Witching Hour is brought to you by La La Noon, a children's store founded by two mothers offering a range of local, sustainable brands with a focus on well-made, timeless and stylish clothing, toys and gifts.
From brands like Oliella to The Wholesome Store to Len Label, you'll find one-of-a-kind quality pieces that can be played with and worn again and again, and then passed on to loved ones. Shop their thoughtful edit now at lalanoon.com.au. Hello and welcome to Witching Hour, the show that looks at what's exciting, delighting, intriguing and frustrating us when it comes to making work, work. I'm Lou.
And I'm Loz, coming to you first up with a good news story. Studies show that women make fewer mistakes on their periods. Women were found to perform better during their periods compared with any other phase of their cycle, with faster reaction times and fewer errors. This was despite women feeling worse on their periods, including lower mood and suffering physical symptoms.
Actually, can't believe this. It is quite mind-blowing. You always think of that luteal phase as your productive, intelligent, sort of fast-moving, quick-paced phase. And this has also reminded me, Lossie, that we actually have to do a whole segment on this because we keep saying we will.
I know. Actually, you're so right. You're so right. And I want to live and breathe it too.
Yeah,
I'll do a little vlog on it. It is amazing.
I did something really smart today because I'm bleeding. Today, where to start when you don't know what career you want? A lot of mums go through that, and I cannot wait to hear what you have to say. And we have to talk about That the Bear episode, Ice Chips, that depicts perhaps the most profound labour scene I've ever seen. Take it away, my friend.
Where to start when you don't know what career you want? Feeling stuck about what occupation to pursue is not reserved to one part of life. Whether it's returning to work after parental leave or being at the same organization long enough to have long service leave, not knowing which career step to take next can be super overwhelming. It also feels, from my perspective, that there's more at stake. So I know everyone's like, oh, you have a career for ages and you'll win the workplace for ages. I get that. But the older you get, the more cemented in your ways you get, the more comfortable you feel, the more pressure you feel. And it becomes this all-encompassing feeling, particularly if you want to change industries and not just jobs, of how do I do it and what next?
Also just finding the space, like finding time once you have kids or looking after anyone. It might be aging parents, it might be a sibling, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I always find when I'm trying to even just propel this career, finding the fucking space to, for example, submit that article to a newspaper or whatever. It's just, I never get that extra space to do those things.
Yes. And that is part of it, right? You need the time. You need the time to actually sit with yourself and be like, what do I want? What do I like? Yeah. What am I passionate about? What can I see myself doing for an extended period of time? So to make everybody feel a little less shite, the youth of today, which makes me laugh because I feel youthful,
we're not the youth,
but I'm
are
no
we?
Longer in that.
Our children are closer so to the youth of today.
Yeah. The youth of today will work as many as 17 different jobs across 5 different careers over their lifetime. And if that's not enough to calm you, another study advises that 85% of jobs that will exist by 2030 don't even exist yet.
That's sick.
It is sick, isn't it? I wanted to bring this discussion specifically to you, Lou, because you're in this exact position. So you have changed career at that cusp of becoming a mum. I want to understand why, number one, and how you went about doing it.
So I would say my bigger career change was pre-motherhood, about 3 or 4 years out. I can't remember exactly now, but I was the marketing manager in the family business at an architecture and design firm, always a writer in the background and did odd bits and pieces in media in the background. But I always thought I would be more of a journalist type. That's what I always wanted to do. And I don't know what propelled it, but I just looked around one day And I was like, this isn't it. Do you know what's interesting? I think the backdrop of staying in that job was that it provided flexibility and it was the family business. And because I wanted to be a mum so much, I've never thought about this until right now. Yeah. I think part of me stayed thinking that this will be a great job when I'm a mum and this yes. is the family business. So this will work really easily. And I've only just really made that connection now, but I think it made me stay a bit longer because it was just easy. It would have been easy. I left, probably would have been earning double what I am right now if I stayed there, but I left and went through a few years of really challenging, shitty jobs, all freelance, trying to make it in media. It was interesting because at that time, Hayes and I were about to get married too. And I remember thinking, you're about to become a wife. Not that that means anything, like who the fuck cares? But I remember just yeah. thinking, I thought people that got married were a bit more
had their shit together
than this. We semi-lived with Hayden's parents because our house was in Rye and we were still very much living and working in Melbourne then. So we spent about half the week at his parents. And I remember just thinking, I thought you'd have it together now, my sweetie. You do not.
You never do. You never do. It doesn't matter what phase of life you're in. I feel like something always just doesn't run as smoothly as you're expecting. But what made you take the jump and how did you actually do it?
I think motherhood again probably made me take the jump because in my head I was probably 3-4 years off trying to conceive. It felt like that now or never. If I'm going to make the change, it's going to take time. I need to do it now. I hate to say it, but it was all connections and hustling. It was messaging yeah. anyone I knew and getting any connection I knew. So my brother was entrenched in cycling. So he got me a gig in Cycling Australia's sort of sports media arm. And so I would go off on these national road races and do the media and bits and pieces there.
Did you wear bike shorts?
Absolutely not. And speaking of last week's episode, I won't be putting them on anytime soon.
Oh,
work
up.
On the body, love, don't I?
As if.
So then it was sort of one thing after the other. I worked for Channel 7 a bit, Tennis Australia a bit, all these weird contract jobs and all these outward jobs that would have looked cool to other people. But what was in the backdrop of that was all these really shitty social media jobs that really paid for me to then be able to take these opportunities to start to build up to the career I wanted. Yep. And then I applied for a job at Cricket Australia in a broadcast role. Very funny side note there. I got down to the last two. This other woman got the job ahead of me. And then I ended up going on as a casual. So I would see her about. She didn't last that long there. And I remember her taking this phone call at the desk. She was gossiping with an ex-colleague in front of like 20 people at these sort of hot desks for like half an hour. And it was the most uncomfortable half an hour in my workplace life. So a little side story there. I just don't think that's appropriate. And I was like, you should have hired me, Dalsies. Eventually got a full-time job.
Well, they
there,
did.
And then they hired me. And then I stayed put until I had Ray. Wasn't sure if I would go back. If I lived in Melbourne, but maybe I would have, but the extra layer of Rye motherhood travel at that time didn't feel worth it. And also I'd started working on Ready or Not.
Yes. Yeah. What about when you started working on Ready or Not? Like what was it? I mean, it's very different, Lou, to what you previously did. I know it's production, don't get me wrong, but owning your own business is very different because there's so many complexities that come with it. Like,
oh yeah, you've taught me all about that. No, things that I didn't realize until like the other day when we did our strategy day. Loz, if nobody... I knew all that on day one, maybe I wouldn't have done it.
No, but like, how did you actually get up to speed?
I think it just felt more like a vocation for so long because I was yeah. privileged in that Cricket Australia gave me 3 months of that full-time paid leave. I think that gives you a decent buffer because then you add yes. on the government leave. And then because I did other freelance work really until the last few months, and probably I guess more so when you came on board, but then maybe like 4 or 5 months after that, have I started to take it more seriously as proper work or a proper job? Before that, it just felt like a creative pursuit that I loved.
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting fact for you. And I don't know if you know this or not. I started off in finance.
I did not know that. I'm not surprised. You're one of the smartest people I know. What was your inter school? Like, I know we don't want to boast about these things, but go on, tell it right.
Well, it's not even called that anymore. So that's how depressing it is. Yeah, but it was 97.9.
Yeah, you're very smart. So were you good at numbers in school? I've never asked you that.
No, it's terrible.
So what were your subjects? What did you do well in to get, not to pivot too hard, but where was your brain at in year 12?
My brain was that I like to get good marks. And so I strategically picked subjects like Japanese and German. Can't even speak them.
Languages get you such a high upmark.
Yeah. So the theory for me was even if I do average in hard subjects like specialist maths or chemistry, which I did, and Japanese and German, even if I just scrape by, the markup is so high that the likelihood of me getting a good score is.
I need to pause. Your five subjects in year 12 were chemistry, specialist maths, English, German, and Japanese. That is so smart.
No, I'll one up you on that. I did Japanese and German in year 11.
Oh, my word. You're a genius. You're a child genius.
I'm not a genius. Can't speak any of that.
Although you're not the youth of today anymore, so I can't call
you a child genius. No, absolutely not. No, I can't remember anything, like anything. I wouldn't even know what that hypothesis, what's it called? The triangle in algebra.
I feel like you're talking about the hierarchy of needs. No, I'm kidding.
Anyway,
comfort.
yeah. So I started off in finance. I did a internship when I was so young, like Ash Uni, because I did a commerce degree. When I was studying it at uni, I did it because this sounds so ridiculous and it actually is horrific. Everyone I knew that had like an amazing life, these are old white blokes, was like a stockbroker. I was like, maybe it's fun. Like maybe this can make a quick couple. Cash, make some big cash.
Can go to Europe every year.
Yeah, just live my life. And then I interned at Deloitte and it was the most horrific experience of my fucking life. I sat there and I didn't click with anybody. Like I'd crack a joke and people would be like, this chick is unhinged.
Yeah.
And it was obviously unpaid. So those were the days when it was unpaid over the whole of summer. And all I could think about every day was I hate finance.
Did you have like an is this it thing? Like, did you feel stuck?
No. Do you know when I had a this is it thing at my very first job when I was still at uni, I worked in accounts payable and accounts receivable. And as I was doing the reconciliation,
you'd be fucking good at that.
Yeah. I'd be like, mate, pay your shit. You're late. Yeah, yeah. No. But as I was doing reconciliation, I thought to myself, I have too much personality for this. Like, looking at a spreadsheet every day. And I thought, oh, you know what? I'm still at uni. I can still do some marketing gigs here. But what I did at the time is, and I mean, it was a long time ago, but what I did at the time is I spoke to my finance manager and said, I'm really interested in marketing. I'm interested in learning essentially anything else about this business while I'm still studying. That is not finance.
Yeah.
Anything. And that came from like, I went to the warehouse. I was like looking at these ATM machines out the back and how they take cash.
And you're like, give me some of that.
Yeah, well, I was like, give me some.
But can we print some right now?
Weird things like that, like just having a curiosity or that inquisitiveness has always served me well.
I want to ask you just quickly there. I know you and that you're a confident person who's pretty comfortable in a room full of strangers. Were you that way inclined as a uni student? Were you happy to just go up to the manager and say, teach me X, Y, and Z, take me to the warehouse, take me to the marketing team?
Yes, because I don't think you have anything to lose. And I still feel like that in life.
Like, see, I wasn't like that. I was the nervous little person that was very polite and a bit nervous to ask for opportunities.
But you don't have to ask for an opportunity. You just have to have a curiosity about something else.
But I think you're so incredible like that. I don't think many people have that, what you have.
Really? Even just a conversation. So let's just say I was sitting in the lunchroom eating my tuna on crackers or my tuna noodles or whatever on earth I was cooking, which was shit. It was awful. Probably baked beans on toast, to be honest, which I still love. I would speak to a lady in finance sitting at the table called Winnie and be like, what do you do, Winnie? Like, what's the next step?
Is this actually someone? Like, or is this a pretend person?
Her name was Winnie. And I was like, hey, you're three levels above me. What do you do? Explain your role. Like, is it appealing? But this is in the same team. I was in finance. Like, what do you do?
True.
And the more she spoke about, the more my mind was like, la, 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 la. I was like, okay, I don't aspire to be that. So I'm like, okay, who else is in the business? What do you do, Larissa? Like, what's your role? in marketing. How does that work? What do you do on a daily basis? The more questions you ask, and when you're asking people questions about themselves, but what would I do today? And I think this is a valid question for people that are in their 30s, or perhaps you're moving towards your 40s and you're thinking to yourself, there must be something more to this career of mine.
Yeah.
Everybody I know at some point has had that thought. Everybody.
Yeah. And you learn so many skills in your 30s and your 40s, don't you?
Yeah. And I feel like it's between that 30s and 40s mark when you actually think about it more deeply. So here is my advice. And this is also what the article said, just by the way. It's not just me just blabbering about what I think is right. Network, meet new people, ask questions, any question. Understand your value. So what is it about you that makes you unique? And I think this is so basic sometimes. It can be like, Lou, you are great at making people feel heard. That's your like superpower, for example. Maybe somebody else's would be, I'm super organized. I could manage a diary to a T. It doesn't necessarily have to be this like skill that's set in stone. Like I have great communication skills. Like scrap that. What is it about you that is so innately you that people think, oh, Lou, that's why I remember her.
Do you know what we often do with these skills too? I think we undersell them because we think so many other people have these skills, but they're more unique than you think.
They don't.
I've noticed this. I am very organized in my production work, not so much in my home life. And I really took that for granted or glazed over or glossed over it and didn't think much of it until I went on parental leave and saw how other people run things or ran things and thought, gee, that's really dropped. You could pick that up a little bit. And so you need to celebrate your skills more for what they are because they don't seem that much on paper, but they're huge.
But be specific about it. I think this is where people get unstuck. People are like, oh, it's so overwhelming. There's so many skills. There's communication skills. There's organization skills, there's problem solving skills. Ignore the problem solving. Like, what problem are you good at solving? Like, is it you have a knack for creating morale amongst teams that are super introverted and don't like to communicate with other teams? That is a superpower of yours. Say it. Figure out the team that's going to need you most and insert yourself. Next thing, put up your hand for experience or volunteer within either the company that you're in so that you can get out of there. Or, for example, message somebody and ask if you can volunteer or shadow them for a day. Most people will say yes. The final thing, spend time with people that motivate you, inspire you, and can guide you. Experimentation takes time. If you're not surrounding yourself with people that you feel comfortable with, that you want to be like, it can be a bit difficult to actually find your groove. And you are never too old to swap or change careers. Reason being, Australians are retiring at their oldest since the 1970s. We are seeing the average age of retirement now around 65, and with financial pressures increasing, no doubt this will probably tip over into 70 by the time we're a bit old. So if you're 30 or perhaps you're closer to 40, it's another 25 years minimum in the workplace.
This is a bad news segment. This has turned into a bad news segment.
No, it's not.
I'm kidding.
But I'm more so saying, like, I know I can feel like a hard slog at the time, but far out, 25 years, I wouldn't have thought you would have people listening to that haven't even done that. So it's like more than what you've spent.
I have a brilliant quote for this. I've seen somewhere along the lines of whether you study that course or not, that five-year course, those 5 years are going to go by regardless. So, you know, when you look at a uni course and you think, for example, I would love to study psychology one day. It's always been the other career option for me. And I still sometimes think I would love to be a psychologist. And I always just put it straight on the back burner because that's at least 5 years of study. 5 years of my life are going to go by either way. So I think it's a really great way to think about it.
Yeah. And if you're worried about money or you're like, oh God, I can't be bothered to do hex debt again. I can't be bothered to have like this enormous uni debt, this enormous time debt. Start with providers like Udemy for Business who are excellent. A lot of their courses are like micro courses. I feel like you absorb more because they're small, targeted and tailored. They're under $50. Most of them are around $20. Or better yet, go with Coursera. Most of their courses are free.
Amazing. I haven't heard of either of those.
Oh, they're excellent. Excellent. There you go. To end on, I wanted to give some celeb examples of people that have changed their careers who are somewhat relatable. And these are fascinating too. Vera Wang, wedding dress designer and jewelry designer, and bloody, I mean, I've got a champagne glass by her. She's designed a lot of stuff.
I love that. Yeah,
with the bow, you know?
Gorgeous. Haven't seen it.
Beautiful. Oh, it's beautiful. Vera Wang was a figure skater and a journalist before entering the fashion industry at 40. Today, wow. She's one of the world's premier women designers.
Figure skater and journalist would not like, have had that on her resume.
Absolutely. Another great one. Billionaire Spanx founder Sarah Blakely sold office supplies door to door for 7 years in her 20s before her line of slimming footless pantyhose launched to success in 2000. She quit her sales job at 30 to run her company full time.
And we know that went pretty well for her.
Exactly right. So if not now, when? Go for it. If you're thinking of a career change, put the things in place to just do it.
We need to talk about ice chips, the labor episode that everyone is talking about in season 3 of The Bear. So in this episode, Ice Chips, we see Calm's sister, Sugar, who's also known as Natalie, in what might be one of the most profound depictions of labor I have ever seen. It's scary, but not because it's gory or gruesome or harrowing. It's mundane in that it shows the in-between moments of labor in a way that I've never really seen before. And it's emotional in that it shows what can happen to birthing people more broadly as they cross that threshold. All of the anxieties and fears and questions about both childbirth and life. I feel like it's sort of this metaphorical episode of what's happening right there, but then what's happening more broadly. There's a lot to get through here. So there are quite a few big themes that I want to talk through. The first one is the mother-daughter relationship between Donna and Sugar. We see something really profound happen in that room that I think speaks to the rebirth of a mother. That's something spoken about, that when you have a baby, it's not just the birth of your child, it's sort of the rebirth of yourself in a lot of ways. But I think we see more than that. I think capture this rebirth of Donna as well, the grandmother, or who becomes the grandmother. We also see Donna pushing her own birthing agenda on her daughter, which I think is a really big one, because this just happens to every single person on the planet. It might 100%. Not be from a mum, it might be from a friend, but there is something about someone giving birth that makes other people go. So that's something else quite profound in this episode. The next one is the way the doctor's actions impact Sugar's experience and birth plan so profoundly. It's interesting because we don't see the outcome of it, but we do see the way she navigates a system that sort of tells her it's her choice, but without giving her much choice at the same time. It's really interesting seeing the sort of paradox between what is actually offered and what is just sort of thrust upon her. So we'll get to that.
Yeah.
It's also the first time, as I've mentioned, that I've seen such mundanity in labor play out. It's really perfectly depicted in those breaks between these surges. And it's something you just never see. You normally see the waters break in Hollywood and then you see the end result and you see the sweat. You might see some really, really full-on contractions and pushing, and then you see the baby. So this was interesting because we didn't see the baby, or we didn't see the final result. We didn't see the birth, but we did see that really mundane, sort of almost lonely, private, scary moment of going through labor. There's some other really subtle nuances that I want to discuss with you.
I haven't heard subtle nuances mentioned in the birth suite, but by all means, tell me.
It's a lot, isn't it? So we'll set the scene first. Sugar, aka Natalie, is starting to experience labor as she's in the car buying paper towels for the restaurant, which, you know, making work work. Love that merging of motherhood and career. And she calls her mum, who's also known as Donna, as the absolute last resort to be with her until her partner, Peter, can arrive at the hospital, who's on some sort of like sports weekend away, by the way, while his wife is due.
Yeah, I didn't really understand that bit.
Yeah, it was very hard to understand.
Yeah, and when you said last resort, just for some context setting, she called like four other people before
called everyone. Fuck.
I actually just need somebody. Yeah.
Which is another really interesting sort of poetic moment to me, because she actually needed someone. She couldn't do that on her own. She needed someone with her, and it was quite beautiful in the way it played out. So these two, Loz is laughing at me. Good. I'm really waxing lyrical.
I've got such a different opinion of this episode, so I just can't wait to get into it.
This is really showing our different shades. So these two have a really troublesome, I'd say traumatic relationship that we're familiar with by now, whereby Natalie always plays the carer of her mum. But as we see her, she's about to cross over to motherhood herself, and she's getting ready to care for her baby. So things are starting to, I guess, flip for her, and things are about to change. I want to talk about the mother-daughter relationship first.
Yes.
Something we often hear in motherhood for a lot of people is that it's the first time that you're really setting boundaries for yourself and maybe standing up for yourself. And we see that play out really intimately. Firstly, though, what really captured my attention here was when Donna cries talking about the fact that Sugar can't remember her grandmother, and Donna says, "You don't want to." And it's one of those relearnings of those moments where you realize that your parents are people. You know, when you're younger and they seem like superheroes who have all the answers, and bit by bit you learn more. And I thought that was a really interesting moment where Sugar just learns a little bit more of why Donna might be the way that she is. It doesn't excuse her behavior, but it's just a little learning moment. Then Sugar finally says the things that she's been, you're really laughing at me.
Oh, it's just so funny. Like I love the way when you watch something, you really think about these like intricate little moments.
That's
like,
so, I can't wait to hear it. Yeah, go in with yours now.
My perspective just quickly on the mother. What's the mother's name again?
Donna.
She's just whack.
She's whack. Yeah. There's no doubt.
And like, all I could think to myself was, bitch, this is your birth experience.
Yes.
Sit down, be quiet.
So I totally agree with you. She is unhinged, but I think the show does brainwash you in the way it's written to empathize with her, because in an episode that you might not have seen, we see her as this absolute monster, but it still gives these shades of, I guess, the inner turmoil she's going through. And at the start of this episode, I was like, stop making this about you, bitch. Stop making this about you.
That's what I thought.
But by the end, there was this weird forgiving moment, because she does make herself scarce and she does sort of let go, which is another thing I want to get to, by the way. But before we do, one big thing for me is that Sugar actually finally stands up for herself and is able to say to her mum, because it would be really hard and crushing to say to your mum, you destroyed me in some way. So she's able to say that for the first time in her life, after always being the carer, always being saying things like, are you okay, and driving her mum mad for the first time.
Yeah.
She's saying, this is my ship that I'm steering. You can either get on and be a good person to me or get the fuck off, but this is what you've done to me, and this is why I'm so scared of having a daughter myself.
But don't you think labor brings really like the truest, most authentic version of yourself?
Yes.
When you're like so in that moment, you're like, Ryan,
you're an animal.
Shut up. Yeah. You are the below the moss right now. Like,
yes.
Quiet. Because it's such a, all eyes are on you and it's your body. And so,
well, it's animalian experience.
So you have this innate ability to be like, say the things that you want to say and no one will question you. Yeah.
If I have a third, I might save up a few truths actually, just get them all out in the birth suite. Who can get angry at that? No one.
No one, exactly.
So on the topic of letting go, I do think we see her let go. We see this unhinged, chaotic mum that's pushing her own birthing agenda on her and telling her that she has to have oxytocin, and makes her so fearful of not having oxytocin and what that might do to her, and talks about that, oh, I walked to my birth and how amazing am I, to slowly through the middle of it starting to say, it's whatever you want. This can be whatever you want. You're going to be okay. And then at the end, I thought, she ain't going to leave. This bitch ain't going to leave. And she does. And Peter stands out the front with her and they have this beautiful moment where they're crying. And he says to her, what do I do? And she says, you just stand with her. And she leaves. And for me, this was an incredible moment of realizing that it's so hard to let go of your children, even when they're adults.
Yes.
You know how she licks her thumb and tries to wipe something off her face. And she says, you get so mad at me when I do these things, so I feel like I can't. I feel like that was another, you're my baby and it's so hard to let go of you. So for me, that was another, I'm sorry to keep being poetic and very deep, but it was another.
You really
sort of
read into this
crossing.
Episode.
Yeah, I did, didn't I? I read into everything. Have you not learned that by now?
Welcome, I was like, to it my sucked. Scary double brain. Speed.
So yeah, that was a real threshold sort of crossing moment for me. I have two more main themes that I want to talk to you about. One of them I've already alluded to a bit, which is Donna pushing her own agenda. And I want to know from you, how did that manifest when you were pregnant, specifically with Sienna, people pushing their own agendas on you?
It made me be more stringent about what I wanted.
Yeah.
I'm one of those people where I'm always open to other people's opinions and I love learning and I love taking on different perspectives in a manner that is polite, that is respectful, and that doesn't make me feel like A, I'm an idiot, B, it's polarizing. Like if I don't do this, this will happen.
Which is often the birth discourse is like, if you don't do this.
Exactly. So when people say things that are like, oh, you know, you don't need an epidural, just see how you go. I'm actually more inclined to go the other way.
Yeah.
If I know that it's on the radar for me, like I did for Sienna, I was like, look, modern medicine, I'm all about it. I want to feel comfortable. I want a positive experience where I have multiple children afterwards. Labor, I don't think is for me. I can't even get a needle without pretty much passing out. So I went in and was like, I want the epidural, like immediately.
Yeah. Like, and that's the choice of yours. Like, I think it's interesting in this because I was realizing as I was writing my notes that I was annoyed that she then wanted it because she didn't originally want it.
Yes.
But on the flip side of that, it's still a choice of hers. But where I think birth choices become really muddy and where I guess the pushing of agendas fucks things up is for you, for example, if someone tried to talk you away from what you wanted, away from having an epidural, that would have pissed me off too. Whereas it's interesting that mum, a birthing person's innate feelings about what they want can get so heavily rocked. For me, it doesn't matter what the outcome is. It matters more what that original choice is and how that then manifests.
It's hard for me to comment on this one because I have never had that experience.
Yeah. But you had a great birth experience.
I did, but what I will say is that I did advocate for myself. So with Sienna, I'm sure many other people have had a similar experience, but I asked for the epidural before I was induced. So it would be like you or I, again, walking into hospital normally and saying, hey, Susie, would you mind giving me an epidural?
Plug it up, baby. I'm about to give birth.
Exactly. The amount of resistance, the first midwife was like, oh, like normally wait till I don't care if that's what you normally do. Like I've asked the right questions. I know that I'm entitled to it. That's what I want. Let me just double check. I'll get back to you. No problem. The next person, are you sure you don't want to like wait till your waters are broken first? No, no, thank you. Yeah. I'd prefer not to. The next person, just double checking. I feel like because I am so what I want is what I want.
Yeah.
It didn't feel bad for me to continually ask. However, I would think if I was someone that was more cautious or nervous or people pleaser, that would have rocked me. Like the first time I've been
like, ask you that because you're very forthright in your opinion and what you want and you're comfortable going for it. But it would have made you empathize with people that aren't that way inclined, right? Because then the whole thing can be derailed.
Even if you are that way inclined, by the time the third person asked, I was kind of thinking to myself, is there some medical reason why I shouldn't be having, is it going to cause emergency C-section? Will this cause distress for the baby? Like those are the kind of thoughts that I'm having.
Yeah.
But if it was one person that asked, I'd be like, oh, whatever. But once it's three, I'm like, come on guys, like, what's going on here? Why do you keep asking me? Yes.
Just plug me up. It's so good that we've had such different birth experiences actually, because I feel like I can learn a lot from yours and probably vice versa.
I should probably take a leaf out of your book for the third one.
I think choice is the power here. It's about having your choice and feeling good about it. Yeah. I'm all on board with your third one. That's fine by me. This does bring me to the last point, which is the interaction with medical staff in this episode. It's hard to exactly what is applicable to an American audience versus ours. I think it's quite similar in the way that it plays out, but I wish that I could say for sure exactly how an American hospital normally operates and if this is very much within those realms. But we initially see the midwives. We see Natalie ask for them to dim the lights and put on some music. She wants to avoid pain relief and any sort of induction, and she wants a calming environment, which really lends itself to what I was talking about earlier about how I feel like the birth suite and how you're feeling in that space can sort of be a bit of a manifesto for how you're feeling about life too, because she didn't feel these things growing up with her mum, and she really wanted to bring her daughter into this loving, happy environment. It wasn't just about a calming birth. It was sort of a manifestation for all these things. So she has that pretty calming conversation with the midwives. And then when the doctor checks in, he examined her without asking and tells her she's only 5 or 6 centimeters dilated. And you see those fears start to creep in. Firstly, I would think that 5 or 6 centimeters is pretty fucking far along personally. Like, that's pretty good dilation.
I mean, how do you know? It's so subjective. You're like, well, I've got to get to 10, but that could take 5 minutes or 5 hours.
5 hours, exactly. And that's where she goes to. She starts to ask how long things will take. He says he can't tell her. He has this interesting paradox of that he examines her without even asking for her consent. But then once she starts to think through and talk through her potential options to speed this up, he says, well, it's your choice. And so she's in this really hard position that so many birthing people have been in, where you want your baby to be safe. You want to feel good about what's happening to you.
Yes.
You probably really want this thing to be over with, because let's face it, even if you want a really sort of empowering physiological birth, we don't want to be in
labor
forever.
You don't want to be there 5 days. Yeah.
Exactly. And so she sits at this juncture that so many have been through, where they start to doubt all of their wants, all of their goals. And she starts to say, I think it's right if I just have the Pitocin. We don't see the result of it, but I don't think I've ever seen such a loaded example of what the birthing person goes through in the suite.
Yeah,
you and
I
again,
agree with that.
Haven't quite had that experience. Birth was quite quick for me and I didn't have pain relief. And then on the other end, you had it at the beginning. So neither of us have been at that really prickly position where we've had to make a decision, but we see her start to enter that position and it does make you feel really vulnerable for her and how scary that would feel. And all those competing needs of your mum's there saying that you should definitely have the oxytocin. Then there's someone there saying that you're only a little bit dilated. And then you're thinking about your baby. You're thinking about yourself. There's so much that goes through a pregnant person's head when they're about to give birth. And it really made me feel for her in that moment and want to like cheer for her. And I don't think there was anyone there doing that. She was just sort of on her own.
We had an episode a while ago and it was actually on Ready or Not. And it was talking about how important a birthing partner, whether that's your partner or your mum or someone advocating for you, because it's those questions that seem like a relief and yet loaded at the same time when you're in the midst of birthing, that are so difficult to answer. Like, well, it's your choice. It's like, well, what would you do?
Yeah. Like, and also like you just had your fingers in me, and I'm not even joking when I say that, but you are a doctor that just inserted your fingers in me,
like, tell
and
me what
didn't
to
even
do.
Give me an option of that. So now I feel like vulnerable to you. Like I feel like you've just taken over my body and I'm not even sure if it's mine now.
Yeah. Which is why I think it is so important to have those conversations well in advance with the person that you're expecting in your delivery room.
And maybe Peter should have actually been there by that.
Yeah, no shit, instead of watching his fucking sports game. Because in those moments that are stressful, I can imagine the first thing that I would be thinking about is, well, what do you, you're the expert. You 100%. Tell me.
Yeah.
But in fact, they're not the expert because it's your body. Your body is the expert. So you're like, come on, bod, what do you want to do here?
Yeah. Fucking give me an answer because this is stressful.
Just hurry up and talk to me.
So they were my main themes, but I do have a few questions for you. I don't know if you noticed, but one of the first things that I noticed, no, this one would be in your ballpark. So one of the midwives or doctors asks for Natalie's birth date, and I noticed that the year she was born was 1988. That makes her at least 35, turning 36. Do you think that this was a purposeful script decision, and why, if yes or if no?
Oh, it's a trick question.
It's not a trick question, but I'll tell you what I'm getting at. We've talked so much about these acceptable birth windows, right? Or acceptable windows of when you should give birth or become a mum. I have a feeling that they purposely put Natalie in labor for her first baby over the age of 35 to say something about when women should do what society tells them to do with their bodies.
Oh God, you are such, your mind is so deep.
No wonder I don't sleep well at night.
I heard her say the age, but to be honest, the first thing that came up was, oh, that's close
about
to my
age. But that's exactly right.
Yeah, true.
Do you know what I mean? Maybe that's part of it to make mums that are over the age of 35 feel it. Well, interesting. I'll give you what the poll has thought of that, because you haven't given much yet, but that's fine. We're just showing our different sides of our personality here, which is good. I want to know next, Lozzie, why do you think they didn't show the birth itself?
Okay, I got a few theories on this. Number one, I think it's very difficult to depict through film a natural looking birth unless it's actually happening in real time. I'm yet to see it.
Do you think they were so worried about getting it wrong, maybe because they were going to an effort to try and show labor correctly?
Yes. And I think it would have just looked so cheesy and so corny and so unrealistic, because don't forget, birth for most people is a long experience. It's not like you go and you're like, and then you're like screaming, crying, and the thing pops out. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah. You don't run into your best friend's ex at a Midtown Manhattan restaurant and say, "I curse the day you were born," and have a baby an hour later.
Exactly. And also, once that baby comes out, it does not look, I mean, it cannot, in my mind, be recreated.
Yeah.
Like it just can't. There's so much stuff going on. There's like a layer of ickiness, and then they look blue and squashed.
And you're normally I was shaking after both of my births, like fully shaking.
Yes, but it's just, I don't think you could condense that scene into 20 seconds or a minute. And I think if they tried to, it would have undone all of the work that they've
effort into making it
relatable.
Important, like an important script line, that to all of a sudden show this birth in an episode would have almost devalued that rank. Work. That's really interesting. I also feel like they were trying to show the grit and not the glamour. We see the glamour in those Hollywood movies. They wanted to show like the mundane grit of going through labor and childbirth, maybe.
Yes or no? I mean, she did look quite polished, let's be honest.
She did. And she was lying down the whole time after saying she wanted to move around. I was like, what's going on here?
Get off the bed, sweetie. Have a little trot around. I mean, I guess. So what's your theory on it? What do you think?
I think you've nailed it. I hadn't thought about it so much that way. I thought about that they were trying to show, I guess, the more mundane sides and the more maybe the sides that would feel more important for birthing people and like they're being seen finally, rather than the glorified end goal that we know isn't always as glorious as it looks on script.
No, it's never.
But I think you've absolutely nailed it. I think they were taking the idea of birth and labor so seriously that they didn't want to undo the good work that they did to show sort of some of the more mundane sides of it.
Yeah. Look, I think my synopsis of the episode was birth is complex. It can be very difficult having someone in your space when you're giving birth that isn't on the same page as you. It can also be a very therapeutic experience where you can say things that you otherwise normally wouldn't say and get away with it. And it can be very cleansing and healing. Like once you're birthing a new life, they are so pure that I completely grasp and understand the concept of wanting to bring someone into the world on like a clean slate that you determine is like perfection for you.
That's so interesting that you say clean slate, because in a way it felt like it's that mother-daughter relationship was a bit of a clean slate. They'd finally had some common ground and some love and some fun together when they hadn't in so long. So you are being more profound than you're giving yourself credit, my friend.
But I would say if you're not a deep thinker like me, I'm not sure this is a right show for you. Because quite honestly, I've watched most of season one and I'm still baffled at where my time went. And it's like a cult favorite. People are obsessed with it. And I just can't. There was too much. I love swearing. Like I love it. There's too many curse words for me.
It's really intense. It's an intense show. I want you to try season two and then you can give up.
I don't know that I can push through. I'll try.
Fair enough. I have two more questions for you.
Oh, yes.
Actually, no, we'll give them both a go. Have already answered this one. What stood out to you most watching the way they conveyed labor?
Well, it's difficult because I didn't necessarily have contractions that I felt, but I did feel like the depiction of those contractions was reasonably relatable. Mm. The breathing I couldn't also relate to, but I love the fact that she didn't sound like those other movies, and it's like
like she was actually sort of mooing
and, or screaming
or screaming. It's always screaming in Hollywood.
Well, I'm sure that's what happens, but it also, like, it doesn't start that way, I assume.
Yeah. No, I thought the breathing and her facial expressions and sort of the way she was starting to become a bit sweaty and all of those things, I thought that was pretty bang on to how I reacted through my contractions.
Okay.
So I agree with you. Yes. There. Lastly, do you think a man or a woman wrote this?
A woman. There's no way it was a man. If you say man, I'd be gobsmacked.
Bang on.
Porno, so pornographic scenes if it was a man. It'd be like a nipple or a tit shirt or something. Yeah.
So her name's Joanna Carlo. She's normally a showrunner on the show. She's a mother of two. And I have pulled this out from the Time article, which is one of the articles that I loved reading about the bear. It says, Joanna has spoken openly about working alongside motherhood and found out she was pregnant with her second child while working on the show. Speaking to the LA Times about juggling both, Carlo said, all of a sudden, the game had completely changed. I was navigating being a first-time parent, but I had absolutely no intention of giving up the dream. So I just kept going. She adds, in the end, I've had to push myself to the absolute maximum. I want to be fully immersed in the show and also give myself to the job of being a mother. It's been hard. The difficulty, the frustration, and life not turning out to be a Hollywood dream is reflected in Natalie giving birth. And I love that, just to sort of round things out, because I feel like she's expressing the grit that she's going through in her real life in this show. And all power to you, Joanna Carlo. Not everyone agreed, but I thought that was a really powerful portrayal of labor. So it was just a quick poll, because obviously it was quite niche. I needed people to have seen this exact episode and be willing to come on this journey with me, which, as we know, is quite a fraught journey full of overthinking.
It's very polarizing.
It's a lot. So I did ask if people agreed that there was anything to Sugar having to confirm her age, if they think this was a purposeful decision from the writer. What percentage of people do you think agreed with me that it was a deliberate decision?
Oh, 70%, because I probably love the show and they're overthinkers like you. So
80%.
Am I right? Oh, God.
20% said no. And I was like, how did you not think that? 80% said yes. I then asked, earlier in the episode, Donna really pushes her own agenda onto Sugar when it comes to the birth. What did you notice here? What did it make you think of from your own experiences? Someone said, so in line with the character, but all I kept screaming was, shut the fuck up. Absolutely love that. Feels, I was right there with you.
I felt
you.
That.
Someone said, pissed me off so much. I was yelling at the screen. My birth was nothing like this, which is really interesting. Two other takes here. People just can't help but jam their narratives down your throats, which we agree with. And people love to push their trauma on you to validate their own experiences, which is a really interesting piece of this. Next up was, after going in with a vision to have no intervention, after watching the doctor take a scary call, Sugar says she wants the Pitocin because it's probably the right choice. What do you think the writers were trying to say about how we feel about and talk about childbirth as a society? First answer was, she had barely started, and that being brought up triggered me. Also, the lying on her back. I agree. It was really interesting that she went from saying, I want to move around, to lying there. And yeah, it was just, they were a little bit off with that. The contractions were quite intense, but it did seem to be quite big breaks. I know you probably don't have too much of a theory on that because you haven't felt contractions per se, but it was an interesting paradox there. I don't think they quite nailed how that came together. Another person, and I'll only go into this answer here because I just think this sums it up perfectly, said, why are women not encouraged? We need cheerleaders in that room, which is exactly what you and I have discussed.
Yeah.
And a midwife actually said here that birth is always something that needs to be managed as a medical event, which I think is an interesting one. If you do want it managed that way, as you said, great. But if you go in there with another plan, why is she being derailed
also
so quickly?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's wild.
It's also so funny. Sometimes I think back to this narrative that we're telling girls, which is your body, your choice, which I am clearly all about. And then I place that same narrative into birth, and it so often doesn't feel like that.
Totally. It's interesting. I also wonder if they purposely had a male doctor as the doctor because it felt like this position of power from an older man. Do you think that might have played into it?
Maybe. Absolutely. Maybe. Oh, God. Honestly, Lou, the level, the granular level that you've watch this episode in is inspiring but concerning. I love it. Oh, I enjoy it.
A reflection of my dangerous mind. The it's next so question good. Was, why do you think they left out the childbirth scene itself? This, again, felt deliberate to me. A great answer here is because it wasn't the important part in this context. It's not what builds the character or the story, and I think that is bang on. I think they intentionally wanted that to be a private moment between Sugar and Pete. Mm-hmm. And lastly, I have no idea why, but can they not?
I also think sometimes what happens is that there's a lot of focus, rightly so, placed on the baby and the joy that brings, because, I mean, I've yet to meet anyone that hasn't had a baby, and in that split second of that baby coming out isn't unbelievably overjoyed. And I think therein lies the trick, that if everything leading up to it was traumatizing, in that if everything leading up to it was traumatic, or you didn't feel seen or heard or listened to, I do think sometimes people say, oh, but you had a healthy baby, like, look how happy you were. But it's like that, yes, you got what you wanted, and yes, hopefully you had a beautiful, happy, healthy baby, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, like,
that it was easy and perfect.
Yeah.
It's interesting, as you say that.
So much focus on that one moment, and yet none in the lead up, and you're like, Jesus, if it's 80% lead up and the 10% was good, like, fucking where's your head at after that?
And as you say that, I also think of the people that aren't overjoyed when they meet their baby at first. And it's not because they don't love them, but it's because other things are happening. And maybe that was another fraught decision where they decided to not show the childbirth because they didn't want to show either a really good example or a really bad example.
Also, again, I'm overthinking. Loz is laughing. I mean, I love it. I love this. I love the way your mind works.
Oh, I'm starting to realize how fucking scary I am. What did they leave out that you wish that they showed about labor or childbirth? One person said the stages/frustration, but again, I think this ep was less about childbirth and more about the relationship and the dynamic, the trauma, the identity shift. Another huge one, the identity shift. I know we've sort of spoken on that, but it is. She becomes this person that, like, comes into her power after being this sort of weeping mess around her mum all the time, and it's bloody beautiful to see. Someone said seeing the baby, or the mum seeing the baby for the first time. So I get that. We did want to fucking see that, even though that might have been the whole point. And then the last one, consent. The doc just put his fingers right up there. We did not see consent, and we'd like to see that next time. And lastly, I asked people about the most ridiculous birth scenes they've ever seen from Hollywood. A lot of people said Knocked Up, which is the most obscene birth scene. Go watch that if you haven't. Charlotte's I Cursed the Day You Were Born, and then all of a sudden she's in hospital with her new baby laughing about that Big was the person that put her into a taxi when her waters broke. A million other people said Knocked Up. I've already told you that. The one where she sneezes baby out, I can't think what it's on. Do you remember that one? I can't think of what that is.
No.
Rachel on Friends jumps to mind. That's another great one. The vulva in Knocked Up specifically. So I'm going to go back and see what that person means. And then lastly, TV birth scenes where the baby comes out looking 4 months old, covered in Vaseline and tomato sauce. That's so true. They never look 1 day old. They always look four months old. To be fair, I guess it'd be pretty hard to get a 1 day old baby into a scene.
Absolutely.
And lastly, I asked the community, are you surprised to learn that this episode was written by a mother of two? What do you think was the breakdown of not at all surprised versus actually yes?
No, not at all surprised.
What percentage though, Lozzie?
Oh, like 95. 92.
91. Oh, she's damn close.
I was going to say the one.
So 91% of people were not at all surprised. And that wraps up what has been over an hour of learning that Lucy overthinks literally everything, and Loz has better sleeps at night.
I appreciated your full dissection of that episode. I also appreciate that others like me would have loved that dissection, because it means you probably don't have to waste your 37 minutes and watch it.
Oh, you can just listen to this longer than 37-minute episode.
Also true. On that note, if you have loved today's episode, please leave us a review and follow us on ReadyOrNot.pod. See you next week.
And just a bit of housekeeping. I won't be in your ears next week. Loz will be joined by her best mate, Chrissy. So she's coming back for another go at it. I loved listening to you last time. Best friends, they know each other well, just like us. So they'll bring more brilliance together next week. And then I'll be back with Lozzie the week after.
See you then.